Looks like perspiration stuck the lining to the ice.
Squire shouted down,
Private Honda, get me an ETA on the train.
The radio operator quickly set up the taxat as Squires and Neumeyer made their way toward Pupshaw. The officer settled in slightly above and to the right of the private.
Sorry, sir, Pupshaw said. I must have hit a real icy patch here.
Squires looked at the soldier, who resembled a big spider plastered to a wall.
Private Devon, Squires said, you get above him and dig in. I mean, hold on real tight. Private Neumeyer, we're going to use our rope to try and free him.
Squires grabbed the line that held him to Neumeyer and whipped it up so it was resting on Pupshaw's arms in front of his face.
Pupshaw, Squires said, let go with your left hand and let the rope fall to your waist. Then do the same thing with your right.
Yes, sir,
Pupshaw said. Both Neumeyer and Squires lent him their hands for support as, cautiously, Pupshaw released his grip on the rock face with his left hand, then grabbed it again when the rope had slid down. He repeated with the right hand, and the rope was now level with his belt.
Okay, Squire said. Private Neumeyer and I are going to climb down together. We'll put our weight on the rope, so hopefully it'll slice through the ice. Devon, you be ready to take his weight when it comes free.
Yes, sir,
she said. Slowly, Squires and Neumeyer descended in tandem on either side of Private Pupshaw, the rope snagging on the ice where it had formed between the striker and the cliff. It held for a moment, and the two men put more and more of their weight on the line until the ice shattered in a rain of fine particles. Squires had a firm grip on the cliff, Devon was able to hold on to Pupshaw, and after a tense moment when the rock beneath his right boot gave way, Neumeyer was able to regain his footing with a steadying hand from Pupshaw.
Thank you,
Pupshaw said as the four of them made their way to the bottom of the cliff. When Squires reached the bottom, Sergeant Gray had the team gathered beside the track. There was a space of some 10 yards between the base of the cliff and the track. To the west, roughly 30 yards away, was a clump of trees that appeared to have died some time before the Russian Revolution. Private Honda was already on the taxat, and when he got off, he said that up-to-the-minute NRO reconnaissance put the train at 21 miles to the east, traveling at an average of 35 miles an hour.
That will have them here in just over a half hour, Squires said. Not a lot of time. Okay, Sergeant Gray, you and Neumeyer rig one of those trees to blow across the track.
Sergeant Gray was already unloading the C-4 from the pouches in his assault vest.
Yes, sir.
Devon, Pupshaw, Honda, you three start for the extraction point and secure the route. I don't expect we'll find any disagreeable peasants out here, but you never know. There could be wolves.
Sir, said Sandra, I'd like...
Doesn't matter, Squires cut her off. Sergeant Gray, Private Neumeyer, and myself are all that's needed for this part of the plan. I need the rest of you to cover our retreat if it comes to that.
Yes, sir,
Private Devon saluted. Squires turned to Private Honda, briefing him about the remainder of the mission.
You report to HQ as soon as the bridge is in view. Tell them what we're planning to do. If there's a message from them, you'll have to deal with it. We won't be in a position to use our radios.
Understood, said Honda.
As the three strikers started off through wind-gusted snows that ranged from ankle-deep to knee-deep, Squires joined Sergeant Gray and Private Neumeyer. Gray was already pressing small strips of C-4 to the trunk of a large tree near the tracks. Neumeyer was cutting the safety fuse, leaving the timer fuses they'd brought for Squires to use later. The safety fuses were marked in 30-second lengths, and he had measured out a piece 10 lengths long.
Make it 4 minutes, Squires said, looking over his shoulder. I'm a little antsy about the train being so close that they hear it.
Neumeyer grinned.
We all did the 14-mile timed run in under 110 minutes, sir.
Not in snow with full gear, you didn't.
We shall be okay, Neumeyer said.
We also need to leave time to throw snow on the tree so it looks like it's been there a while, Squire said. And me and Gray have another little job to do.
The lieutenant colonel looked ahead. In 5 minutes they could reach a concave area of granite some 300 yards ahead, one that would protect them from the blast, assuming the concussion didn't bring the cliff down on them. But Gray was experienced enough, and the explosives were small enough that that wasn't likely to happen. That would still leave enough time for one of them to come back and clear away any traces of their tracks in the snow. It had to look as though the tree had cracked and come down by itself. Gray rose when he was finished, and Squires squatted as Neumeier lit the fuse.
"Let's go," Squires said.
The lieutenant colonel helped Neumeier up, and the three men ran toward their little sanctuary, arriving with a minute to spare. They were still catching their breath when the sharp report of the low explosive blast tore through the night, followed by the brittle cracking of the tree trunk and a dull thud as it hit the train tracks. Chapter 54. Tuesday, 11:08 p.m., Hokkaido. The two crewmen glass cockpit was low, flat, and dark behind a narrow curved windshield. Three of the six flat color screens in the cockpit formed a single tactical panorama, while an extra wide HUD, heads-up display, provided flight and target information that expanded upon the data contained on displays mounted inside the visor of the pilot's helmet. There were no dedicated gauges. The displays generated all of the information the pilot required, including input from the sophisticated sensors mounted to the exterior. Behind the cockpit was a matte black fuselage, 65 feet 5 inches long. There were no sharp angles on the flat-bellied craft, and the Notar tail system, no tail rotor, and advanced bearingless main rotor made the Mosquito virtually silent in flight. Ducted air, forced under pressure through gill-like sections in the rear fuselage, provided the craft with its anti-torque forces. A rotating directional control thruster on the tail boom enabled the pilot to steer. Already relatively lightweight because of the absence of drive shafts and gearboxes, the craft had been stripped of all extraneous gear, including armaments, which cut the aircraft's empty weight from 9,000 to just 6,500 pounds. With an extra tank of fuel carried outside and burned off first, so the bladder could be jettisoned over the sea and recovered, and coming home from a mission 1,500 pounds heavier than it went in, the Mosquito had a range of 700 miles. It was a breed of flying machine the press and lay public called stealth, but which the officers of the Mosquito program at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base preferred to call low observable. The point of such aircraft was not that they couldn't be seen. Enough radar energy directed at the F-117A or the B-2A or the Mosquito would enable an enemy to see it. However, there was hardly a weapons system in the world that could track and lock on to such an aircraft, and that was its advantage. None of the low-observable aircraft currently in service would have been able to execute the mission at hand, which was why the Mosquito program had been inaugurated in 1991. Only a helicopter could fly in low over mountainous terrain at night, deposit or extract a team, turn around and get out again. And only a low-observable could hope to do that in the carefully monitored and cluttered skies of Russia. Flying at 200 miles an hour, the Mosquito could reach its target at just before midnight local time. If the helicopter took more than 8 minutes to complete its pickup at Khabarovsk, it wouldn't have enough fuel to reach the carrier that would be waiting for it in the Sea of Japan. But having run through every aspect of the mission in the cockpit computer simulator, pilot Steve Kars and co-pilot Anthony Iovino were confident in the prototype and anxious for it to earn its wings. If the Special Forces team did their job, this would send them back to Wright-Patterson heroes, and more important, would deliver yet another body blow to the once proud Russian military. Chapter 55. Tuesday, 3:25 p.m., St. Petersburg.
"General Orlov," Major Levski said, "I've had rather distressing news."
Only the Major's voice came in over the headphones plugged into the computer in Orlov's office. The naval base on the outskirts of the city was not yet equipped with video capabilities, nor, with the budget cuts in the military, was it ever likely to be.
"What is it, Major?" Orlov asked.
He was tired, and his voice sounded it.
"Sir, General Mavik ordered me to recall the Molot team."
"When?"
"I've just gotten off the phone with him," said Levski. "Sir, I'm sorry, but I must carry out..."
"I understand," Orlov interrupted. He took a sip of black coffee.
"Be sure to thank Lieutenant Starik and his team for me." "Yes, sir, I will," Levski said. "You understand, General, that whatever is happening, you're not alone. I'm with you. So is Molot."
Orlov's mouth perked at the edges.
"Thank you, Major." "I don't pretend to know what's going on," Levski continued. "There are all these rumors of an impending coup, of black marketeers being behind this. All I know is that I once tried to pull a vintage Kalinin K-4 out of a nosedive, sir. It had a bear of an engine, a BMW 4, very stubborn."
"I know the plane," Orlov said.
I remember thinking as I burst through the clouds, looking straight down, this is a vintage beauty, and I've no right to give up on her, however temperamental she gets. It wasn't just a duty, it was an honor. Instead of bailing out, I wrestled her to the ground. It wasn't pretty, but we both made it. And then I personally, took that bastard Bavarian mechanism apart and fixed it. She flew. Like a young sparrow, Levski said. Olaf knew he was tired because that Young Boy's Digest story touched him. Thank you, Major. I'll let you know when I get my hands on the damn engine cowl. Olaf hung up and drained his coffee cup. It was nice to know he had an ally, other than his devoted assistant Nina, who was due back at 4. And then there was his wife. She was with him always, of course, but like the dragon slayer who carried his lady's colors into battle, he still rode out alone. And at this moment the sense of isolation was stronger than any he'd experienced, even in the bleakness of outer space. Using the keyboard, he switched back to the channel the militia used to monitor their field forces.
"Want to be left alone," a female voice was saying in perfect Russian. "Leave a surgical assault force free in Russia?" Ruski laughed.
He was obviously communicating with his quarry on his cellular phone, patched together either through the operations center or the local police station.
"We're not an assault force," said the woman.
"You were seen entering the presidential palace with Major Pentti Aho.
He arranged for our transportation. We came to try and find out who killed a British businessman."
"The official report and remains were turned over to the British embassy," said Roski.
"Cremated remains," said the woman. "The British don't accept that he died of a heart attack."
"And we don't accept that he was a businessman," said Roski. "You have another 9 minutes to turn yourselves in or join your dead friend. It's that simple."
"Nothing is ever that simple," said Orlov. Only the faint crackle of static filled the line for what seemed like a very long time.
"To whom am I speaking?" the woman said.
"To the highest-ranking military officer in St. Petersburg," said Orlov, more for Roski's sake than the woman's. "Now who are you? And spare us the cover. We know how you came here and from where."
"Fair enough," said the woman. "We are Comint officers who work with Defense Minister Niskanen in Helsinki."
"You are not!" Roski bellowed. "Niskanen wouldn't risk his resources to disinter a corpse."
DI-6 could not agree on a course of action, the woman explained, so they consulted the CIA and the defense minister. They agreed that it would be less provocative for myself and my colleague to come in and try and find out why he was killed, and once that was accomplished, to try and arrange a dialogue to avoid retaliation.
"Cutouts?" Roski sneered. "You would have taken a direct flight with cobbled passports, gotten in quickly to make your case. You came by midget submarine because you didn't want to be seen at the airport. You're lying!"
"Which route crosses the Gulf of Bothnia?" Olaf asked.
"Route 2, the woman replied.
"How many provinces are there in Finland?"
12.
"This proves nothing," said Roski. "She was schooled."
"That's right," she said, "in Turku, where I was raised."
"This is futile," Roski added. "She's in our country illegally, and in 4 minutes my forces will close in on her."
"If you can find me."
Roski said,
"The Kirov Theater is to your left, at the 10 o'clock position, and there's a green Mercedes behind you. If you try to flee, you'll be shot."
There was another silence. While the woman may have swept the car for transmitters, Olaf knew that she probably hadn't noticed the cellular telephone in the trunk. The line was kept open when an agent was on the job. It didn't show up on transmitter detectors, but allowed them to triangulate the position of the car at all times. The woman said calmly,
"If anything happens to us, you'll lose an opportunity to communicate directly with your counterpart."
"Sir?"
"I'm addressing the ranking officer, not the ruffian."
"Yes," Olaf said. In spite of himself, he liked the way she'd said that.
"I believe, sir, that you are more than just the military head at St. Petersburg. I believe that you are General Sergei Orlov, and that you're in charge of an intelligence unit here in the city. I also believe that more can be accomplished by putting you in touch with your counterpart in Washington than by killing me and returning my ashes to Defense Minister Niskanen."
Over the past 2 years, Olaf and his staff had tried to find out more about their doppelganger in Washington, their mirror image. An intelligence and crisis center that functioned much as theirs did. Moles at the CIA and FBI had been turned loose to discover whatever they could, but the Washington Op Center was much newer, smaller, and tougher to penetrate. What this woman offered, because she was either very clever or very afraid, was the one thing he could not afford to let go.
"Perhaps," said Orlov. "How would you communicate with Washington?"
"Put me through to Major Aho at the palace," she said. "I'll arrange it through him."
Orlov considered the offer for a moment. Part of him felt uneasy about cooperating with an invader, but a larger part felt comfortable trying diplomacy rather than giving an order that was certain to result in bloodshed.
"Release the man you're holding," he said, "and I'll give you your chance."
The woman said without hesitation, "Agreed."
"Colonel," said Orlov.
"Yes, sir,"
Ruski replied, his voice taut.
"No one moves except by direct order from me. Is that understood?"
"It is understood."
Orlov heard rustling and the sounds of muffled conversation.
He couldn't tell whether it was from the car or from the Technological Institute metro stop, where Ruski had gone to catch his rats. In either case, he knew the colonel wouldn't be idle, that he'd do something to save face, and to make sure that the two operatives did not get away.
Chapter 56. Tuesday, 7:35 a.m., Washington, D.C. Hood had learned that the paradox of crisis management was you invariably had to lop off the head of Medusa, face the heart of the situation, when you were most tired. The last time his head had rested on a pillow, Hood was in a Los Angeles hotel room with his family. Now here he was, more than 24 hours later, sitting in his office with Mike Rogers, Bob Herbert, Ann Ferris, Lowell Coffey, and Liz Gordon, waiting for the first reports from a pair of striker teams that had been sent to attack a foreign country. However they dressed up the language, which was what Ann would have to do in press releases if the teams were discovered or captured, that's exactly what Stryker was doing, attacking Russia. Hood's staff was marking time as they waited to hear from either team, and he only half listened as he considered the ramifications of what they were doing. From the out-of-sorts look on Mike Rogers' face, he was evidently doing the same. Coffey hooked a finger under his sleeve and checked his watch. Herbert scowled.
"Checking Mickey's hands every minute isn't going to make the time go any faster," he said.
Liz sat up and jumped to his defense.
"It's like chicken soup, Bob. It doesn't hurt."
Ann started to say something, but stopped when the phone beeped. Hood rapped the speaker button.
"Mr. Hood," Bugs Benet said, "there's a call for you relayed through Major Pentti Aho's office from St. Petersburg."
"Put it through," Hood said. He felt like he did on hot summer mornings, when the air was still and silent and it was difficult to breathe. "Any guesses, Bob?" he asked, hitting mute on the phone.
"Our striker man there may have been caught and forced to call," he said. "I can't think of any other."
"This is Chris," said Peggy.
"Scratch that," said Herbert. "Chris is Peggy's code name if she's free. Kringle if she's stuck in the chimney, so to speak." Hood unmuted the phone.
"Yes, Chris," he said.
"General Sergei Orlov would like to speak with his counterpart," Peggy said.
"Are you with the general?" Hood asked.
"No. We've raised him by radio."
Hood touched mute and looked at Herbert.
"Can this be on the level?"
"If it is," Herbert said, "Peg and George worked a Galilee-grade miracle."
Rogers said, "That's what Stryker's trained to do, and the lady was no slouch either."
Hood unmuted.
"Chris, his counterpart agrees."
A strong voice said in thickly accented English,
"And with whom have I the honor of speaking?"
"This is Paul Hood,"
he answered as his eyes took in the faces of his officers. He noticed that everyone in the room was leaning forward in their chairs.
Orlov said, "Mr. Hood, this is a pleasure."
"General Orlov," said Hood, "I've followed your career for many years."
"We all have. You've many admirers here."
"Thank you."
"Tell me, do you have video capabilities?"
Orlov said, "We do, through the Zontik 6 satellite."
Hood glanced at Herbert. "Can you hook me into it?" The intelligence chief looked as though someone had turned a cold hose on him.
"He'll see the tank. You can't be serious."
"I am."
With an oath, Herbert called his office on his cellular phone, swinging his wheelchair around and huddling over it so Orlov couldn't hear. Hood said,
"General, I would like to talk face to face. If we can arrange that, will you agree to it?"
"Gladly,"
Olaf said. Our respective governments would shudder if they knew what we're doing.
I'm shaking a little myself, said Hood. This isn't exactly standard operating procedure.
That is right, said Olaf, but these aren't ordinary circumstances either.
How true, said Hood. Herbert turned around. We can do it, he said, his eyes imploring, but I urge you to... Thanks, Hood said.
General Olaf? I heard, he said. Our audio is very good here.
What does he think ours is? Herbert muttered. CIA hand-me-downs?
Ask your man to access Channel 24, Olaf said, on what is undoubtedly a state-of-the-art communications control systems satellite dish and transmitter, model CB-7.
Hood grinned at Herbert, who wasn't in the mood. And I ask him, said Herbert, if cosmonauts still urinate on the bus tires before they head to the launch pad.
We do, Olaf said, his voice wafting past Hood's critical expression. Yuri Gagarin started the tradition after drinking too much tea. But women cosmonauts do it too. In matters of equality, we have always been ahead of you, I think.
Anne and Liz both looked at Herbert, who shifted uncomfortably in his wheelchair as he put in the call to the satellite room. It took 2 minutes for the connection to be made, and then the general's face winked on, the thick-rimmed black glasses, strong cheekbones, swarthy complexion, and high, unworried forehead. Looking into those intelligent brown eyes, eyes that had seen the Earth from a perspective granted very few people, Hood felt he could trust them.
Well, said Orloff, smiling warmly, there we are. Thank you again.
Thank you, Hood said.
Now let us be frank, said Olaf. We're both concerned about the train and its cargo. It concerns you enough that you sent a strike force to intercept it, perhaps to destroy it. It concerns me enough to have posted guards to stop them. Do you know what the cargo is? Olaf asked.
Why don't you tell us? Hood replied.
He figured they might as well hear it from the horse's mouth.
Olaf said, the train is carrying currency, which will be used in Eastern Europe to bribe officials and finance anti-government activities.
When? Hood asked.
Herbert raised a finger to his lips. Hood touched mute.
Don't let him try and tell you he's on our side, Herbert said. He could stop the train if he wanted. Someone in his position has to have friends.
Not necessarily, Bob, Rogers pointed out. No one knows what's going on in the Kremlin. Hood unmuted the phone.
What do you propose, General Olaf?
I cannot confiscate the cargo, Olaf said. I haven't the personnel.
You're a general with a command, Hood said.
I've had to have an ally here scan my own line and office for bugs, he said. I am Leonidas at Thermopylae, betrayed by Ephialtes. I'm holding a very dangerous pass here.
Rogers smiled. I like that one, he said under his breath.
Olaf said, but though I can't get to the cargo, it mustn't be delivered. And you mustn't attack the train.
General, Hood said, that isn't a proposal. It's a Gordian knot.
I'm sorry, Olaf said.
A puzzle, one that's very difficult to solve. How can we satisfy those criteria?
With a peaceful meeting in Siberia, Olaf said, between your troops and mine.
Rogers swept a finger across his throat. Reluctantly, Hood killed the speaker again.
Be careful, Paul, Rogers said. You can't leave Stryker out there defenseless.
Herbert added, especially with Olaf's son in charge of the train. The general's looking to protect his boy's butt. The Russians could gun Stryker down, armed or not, and the UN would tell them they had every right.
Hood hushed them with his hand and got back on the phone.
What do you suggest, General Olaf? I will order the officer in charge of the train to have the guards stand down and allow your team to approach.
Your son is in charge of the train, said Hood.
Yes, Olaf replied, my son. But that changes nothing. This is a matter of international importance.
Why don't you just order the train to turn back? Hood asked.
Because I would lose the cargo to the people who sent it, Olaf said. They would simply find another way to transport it.
I understand, said Hood. He thought for a moment. General, what you propose would put my people at grave risk. You're asking them to approach the train in the open, in full view of your troops.
Yes, said Orlov, and that's precisely what I'm asking.
Don't do it, Rogers whispered.
What would you want our people to do when they reach the train? Hood asked. Take as much of the cargo as they can carry out of the country. Hold it as evidence that what is going on is not the work of the legal government of Russia, but of a corrupt and powerful few, Orlov replied. Minister Dugin? Hood asked. I'm not at liberty to remark, Orlov said.
Why not?
Orlov said. I may not win this, and I have a wife.
Hood looked at Rogers, whose resistance to Orlov showed no sign of softening. He wasn't sure he blamed Rogers. Orlov was asking a lot and offering only his word in return.
How long will it take to communicate with the train? Hood asked, aware that the extraction of Stryker could not be delayed.
4 or 5 minutes, Orlov said.
Hood looked at the countdown clock on the wall. The Russian train was due to reach the Stryker position in approximately 7 minutes.
You won't have any longer than that, Hood said. Machinery is in motion.
I understand, said Orlov. Please leave this line open, and I will return to you as soon as possible.
I will, Hood said, then hit mute.
Rogers said, Paul, whatever Stryker was planning will already have been done, whether it's ripping up the track or planning to ambush the train. Depending on the disposition of the taxat, we may not even be able to stop them.
I know, said Hood.
But Charlie Squires is smart. If the Russians stop the train and come out with a white flag, he'll listen, especially if we tell them what to say to him.
Herbert said bitterly, I'm glad you're willing to trust those vodka chuggers. I'm not. Lenin plotted against Kerensky, Stalin against Trotsky, Yeltsin against Gorbachev, Dugin against Zhanin.
Cripes, Orlov is plotting against Dugin. They stab their own in the back, these guys. Think of what they'll do to us.
Lowell Coffey said,
Given the alternative of armed confrontation, and Orlov's heroic nature, Liz said, which seems very important to him.
Right, Coffey agreed. Given all that, the risk seems reasonable.
Reasonable because it's not your two potatoes on the line, Herbert said. Heroic reputations can be manufactured, as Anne will attest. And I'd rather have an armed confrontation than a massacre.
Rogers nodded.
As Lord Macaulay put it back in 1831, moderation in war is imbecility.
Death in war is worse, Liz said.
Let's see what Orlov delivers, Hood said. Though as he watched the small green numbers of the clock flick by, he knew that, whatever it was, he would have only seconds to make a decision that would affect lives and nations, all of it based on what his gut told him about a man's face on a computer screen.
Chapter 57. Tuesday, 10:45 p.m., Khabarovsk. When Orlov raised the train, Corporal Fodor informed him that Nikita had gone to the engine to watch the track ahead. The corporal said it would take a few minutes to bring him back.
I don't have a few minutes, Orlov said. Tell him to stop the train where it is and come to the phone.
Yes, General, the corporal said.
Fodor hurried to the front of the gently rocking car, lifted the receiver of the intercom, and pushed the buzzer on the box beneath it. After nearly a minute, Nikita picked up.
What is it? Nikita asked. Sir, said Fodor. The General is on the line. He said that we're to stop the train where we are, and he'd like to speak with you.
It's noisy up here, said Nikita.
Repeat?
Fodor shouted.
The General has ordered us to stop the train at once and...
The corporal bit off the rest of the sentence as he heard a cry from the engine, through the door and not over the intercom. A moment later he was flung forward as the wheels screeched, the couplings groaned, and the car was jolted hard against the coal tender. Fodor dropped the receiver as he jumped back to help steady the satellite dish, which one of the soldiers had been heads up enough to hold, but the receiver itself was knocked on its side, and one of the coaxial cables was ripped from the back of the dish. At least the bottom-heavy lantern hadn't fallen over, and when the train came to a rest and the soldiers and civilians helped each other to their feet amid the spilled boxes, Fodor was able to check the equipment. Though the connector had been torn off and was still attached to the dish, the cable itself was all right. He pulled off his gloves and began trying to repair it at once.
Because the large boiler sat in front of the cab, the engine's only windows were on the sides. Nikita had been looking out one of them when he saw the fallen tree through the thick falling flakes. He had shouted to the engineer to stop, but when the poor young man didn't act fast enough, Nikita threw the brake for him. The three men in the cab were flung roughly to the floor, and when the train stopped, Nikita heard shouting from above and from the rear cars. He got to his feet quickly, his right hip numb where he'd landed on it, took a flashlight from the hook on the wall, and ran to the window. He searched the snow with the wide beam. One man had been thrown from the top of the first car, but he was already climbing from a snowbank.
"Are you all right?"
Nikita yelled.
"I think so, sir."
The young soldier stood unsteadily.
"Do you need us up front?"
"No,"
Nikita barked.
"Get back on lookout."
"Yes, sir,"
the soldier replied, saluting sloppily with a snow-covered glove as a pair of hands was extended to pull him back to the top of the car. Nikita told the two men in the cab to keep a careful watch at the windows, then he climbed to the top of the coal tender. The winds had stopped, and the snow fell straight down. It was disturbingly quiet, like the cottony silence after a car crash, and the sound of his boots on the coal was crisp and brittle. He scuttled across, kicking up snow and coal dust, then dropped nimbly to the coupling of the first car. Wheezing from the cold, he used the flashlight to find the doorknob.
"Take six men out to the track,"
he hawked at the burly Sergeant Versky as he entered. "A tree has fallen across it, and I want it cleared now.
Have three men stand guard while the other three move it."
"At once, sir,"
said Versky.
"Watch out for possible sniper positions," Nikita added. "They may have night vision capability."
"Understood, sir."
Nikita turned to Fodor.
"How is the phone?"
"It will take several minutes to repair," Fodor said as he crouched beside the lantern.
"Do it quickly,"
snapped the lieutenant, huffing out white clouds of vapor.
"What else did the general say?"
"Just to stop the train and come on the line," Fodor said. "That's all."
"Damn this,"
Nikita said.
"Damn it all."
As the sergeant's crew pulled flares from a supply sack, Nikita ordered the civilians to restack the crates. A soldier came in from the next car, looking slightly rattled, and Nikita sent him back to secure the crates and make sure the soldiers there stayed alert.
"Tell the caboose to be on the lookout,"
Nikita added.
"We may be approached from the rear."
The lieutenant stood with his legs apart in the center of the car, bouncing impatiently on the balls of his feet. He tried to put himself in the place of his enemy. The tree may have fallen, or the tree may have been placed there. If the latter, then the ambush had failed. Had they struck the tree, they'd have been stopped beside a cliff, an ideal place from which to pick off the soldiers on top of the train. But here, hundreds of yards away, they could maybe get one or two soldiers before being spotted. And there was no way anyone could approach the train without being seen, and once seen, shot. So what, then, is their game? His father had called to tell him to stop the train. Had he known about the tree, or had he learned something else, perhaps about explosives or ambushers ahead?
"Hurry!"
Nikita said to Fodor.
"Almost ready, sir,"
the corporal replied. Despite the cold, his forehead was flush and spotting with perspiration. Nikita became angrier with the helplessness he felt, and increasingly aware of a weight in the air around him. It was more than just the isolation and dampered sounds. It was a growing sense that whether he was predator or prey, the enemy he sought was very near. Chapter 58, Tuesday, 3:50 p.m., St. Petersburg.
"I think they forgot all about us."
Private George was amused by the thought as he drove toward the Hermitage, negotiating the tricky turns he had to make after crossing the Moika River. He stayed to the right of the Bronze Horseman, then turned right on Golgaya Street, and made his way toward the adjoining Palace Square. Peggy had shut off the radio after Orloff and Paul Hood had switched satellites, and it became clear that no one else was coming on the line. After leaving their shaken but grateful passenger off, she and George decided to continue on to the Hermitage, where they could leave the car, lose themselves in the crowd, and get their bearings before undertaking the second part of their mission.
"I mean, that's kind of rude, don't you think? We travel like watery walnuts a couple thousand miles, do the job, and no one bothers to get back on the line and say, 'By the way, guys, nice work.'"
"Did you come here for their approval?" Peggy asked.
"No, but it's nice to get it."
"Don't worry," Peggy said. "I have a feeling that before we're out of here, you'll crave anonymity."
As the white columns of the Hermitage came into view, growing amber in the late afternoon light, George could hear and then see the army of workers that Captain Rudnin had warned them about. He shook his head.
"Who'd have ever thought it?
Peggy said. Probably the last time anyone protested here was when it was still called the Winter Palace, and Nicholas II's itchy guards gunned the workers down. It's scary, George said, that there are people who want to bring the Iron Heel back. Which is why I don't mind not getting thanked, Peggy said. It's fear keeps us going, not a pat on the rump. Vigilance is its own reward. That's how Keith felt. George looked at her in the rearview mirror. There wasn't a hint of nostalgia in her voice for her dead lover, nor did he see the loss in her eyes. Maybe she was one of those people who didn't cry in public, or perhaps not at all. He wondered how she would react when they reached the building where Keith had died. There were at least 3,000 people scattered across the large checkerboard of the palace square. They were facing a low stage and podium that had been erected in front of the general staff arch. Police were directing traffic away from the square, and Peggy told Private George to pull over before they reached them. He parked next to an outdoor cafe with brown umbrellas over every table, each umbrella advertising a different brand of beer or wine. "The marketers didn't waste any time coming here," he grunted disapprovingly to Peggy as they stood side by side. "They never do," she replied, then noticed that one of the police officers was looking at them. George noticed him, too. "They'll ID the car," he said. "They won't expect us to stay in the area, though," Peggy said. "As far as they know, we've completed our mission." "Don't you think our friend Ronash has already given them physical descriptions which are being faxed all over St. Petersburg?" "Not quite yet," she said. "But we do have to get out of these uniforms anyway if we're going to leave as tourists." Peggy checked her watch. "We've got to meet Volka in 1 hour and 10 minutes. I suggest we go inside. If we get stopped on the way, I'll tell them we're from the Admiralty, which is a block to the east. I'll say we're just watching to make sure the crowd doesn't spill over. Once we're inside, we'll change, pose as a young couple in love, and make our way to the Raphael." "Finally, a masquerade I can relate to," George said as they started toward the square. "Don't like it too much," Peggy said. "We're going to have a little spat inside, so I can stalk off and strike up a conversation with Volka." George grinned. "I'm married. I can relate to that, too." The grin broadened. "Strikers among strikers," he whispered. "I like the irony." Peggy didn't return his smile as they went around the fringes of the crowd in the palace square. George wondered if she'd even heard him as she looked at the orderly mob, at the sculptural grouping over the general staff arch, at her feet, anywhere but the hermitage itself and the river beyond, on whose banks Keith Fields Hutton had died. He thought he saw dampness in the corners of her eyes and a heaviness in her step that he had not seen before. And he finally, happily, felt close to the person he had been sitting beside, hip to hip, for the better part of a day. Chapter 59, Tuesday, 10:51 p.m., Khabarovsk. Spetsnaz soldiers were trained to do many things with their chief weapon, the spade. They were left in a locked room with just the spade and a mad dog. They were ordered to chop down trees with them. On occasion, they had to dig ditches in frozen ground with them, ditches deep enough to lie in. At a specified time, tanks were rolled over the field. Soldiers who hadn't dug deep enough were crushed. With the help of Liz Gordon, Lieutenant Colonel Squires had made a special study of Spetsnaz techniques, searching for those that best accounted for the remarkable endurance and versatility of their soldiers. He couldn't adapt them all. Regular beatings to toughen the soldiers would never have been approved by the Pentagon, although he knew commanding officers who would have sanctioned them gladly. But he adapted many Spetsnaz methods, including his favorites, their ability to create camouflage in a very short time, and to hide in the unlikeliest places. When he had learned about the soldiers posted on top of the train, he realized they'd be watching the treetops, cliffs, boulders, and snowbanks along the route. He knew that someone in the engine would be watching the tracks for explosives or debris. But he also knew that he had to get under the train unseen, and that the best place to hide would be on the tracks themselves. The glow of an engine-mounted headlight would be diffused and dull, and the soldiers would be paying careful attention to the rails. So he felt safe using a small hatchet to hack through two of the dry old cross-ties, chop a shallow ditch in the rail bed, lie on his back, and have Gray cover him and his sack of C4 with snow, leaving an arm-thick tunnel on the side so he could breathe. After interring Neumeier nearby, Gray hid behind a boulder, far from the train. When Squires and Neumeier tackled the two cars and the fireworks started, Gray would move on his target, the engine.
Squires had heard, then felt the drumming approach of the train. He hadn't been nervous. He was below the surface of the rails, where even the cowcatcher, if there was one, wouldn't touch the snow piled on top of him. His only concern was that the engineer see the tree too soon, or not see it at all, and collide with it. In the latter case, not only would the train be damaged, but the wheels would kick the tree back and over him, in which case he would be, as he'd joked to Gray, ground chuck. Neither of those had happened, but when the train did stop and Squires was able to burrow a little hole in front of his eyes, he saw that he was under the coal tender. That was one car ahead of where he had hoped to be. At least the camouflage worked, he'd thought as he discreetly began to push the snow from himself. There was something very gratifying and historically right about Russian troops falling for a Russian scheme, like Rasputin being killed by Tsarists and the Tsar being killed by revolutionaries. As he'd finished brushing away the snow, Squires had heard shouting. Despite the fact that virtually every inch of skin was covered with Nomex garments, he was cold, a chill that seemed deeper for some reason because of the flat darkness surrounding him. No sooner was he free than he heard boots crunch hard in the wet drifts. This was followed by the lighting of flares, which spread rosy circles of light in the snow and caused the dark underbelly of the train to glow devilishly. Carefully placing his backpack on his belly, Squires began wriggling backward, out of the ditch and along the rail bed toward the first car. Soldiers were moving to the right of him, and he stopped for a moment to unbutton the safety strap of the holster he wore low on his right hip. Though Squires didn't want to cause an international incident, he would rather read newspaper accounts of his crimes and misdeeds than have others read about his death on a frozen plain in Siberia. Squires' backward crawl went quickly, and he was underneath the coupling beneath the coal tender and the first car just as the Russian soldiers reached the fallen tree. This despite the fact that he was pushing up mounds of snow with his shoulders and had to limbo over them backward. Opening the ruck flap, the striker removed the C4 and gingerly pressed it against the metal as flakes of damp, rusted iron fell like snow. When the explosives were secure, he took out the 3-inch diameter timer and, with an insistent push from the heel of his hand, slipped the positive and negative leads into the plastique. There were two buttons above a numeric keypad, and he pressed the button on the left. That turned the unit on, and he used the numeric keypad to enter the countdown. He would give himself 1 hour. After punching in 600000, he hit the button on the top right to lock it in. Then he hit the left button, right button sequence one more time to start the countdown. Squires pushed his feet against the ruddy snow and wriggled to the middle of the first car. He heard thumping overhead toward the upper right. The sudden stop must have dislodged the cargo, and it was being restacked. Kicking backward another few feet, he stopped directly beneath the noise and put the C4 there. He plugged in a timer and repeated the process that would cause this larger batch of plastique to explode. Moving on to the second car, Squires rigged it to go off with a third slap of C4 and a timer. When he was finished, Squires allowed himself to enjoy a long, deep breath. He gazed across his chest toward the front of the train and saw that the men were nearly finished removing the tree. He didn't have much time. Sliding out from under the ruck, Squires set it gingerly to his right as he sidled to the left. When he was out from under the train, he turned over on his belly and lay in the long, flare-cast shadow of the train. He looked at the luminous dials of his watch and was pleased at how quickly the operation had gone. He knew it was one of those things that, had he had time to rehearse it back at Andrews, would have taken 10 or 20% longer to accomplish in the field. Why it worked that way, he had no idea, but it did. He looked back toward the first car and, walking on his elbows, made his way to a drift near the coal tender. He began pushing the snow aside. That was Neumeier's signal to start digging himself out. The private was trembling and had bitten down on the mouth covering of his balaclava to keep his teeth from chattering. Squires gave him a reassuring pat on the shoulder as Neumeier rolled onto his belly. He had been buried with his 9mm Beretta on his chest, and he holstered it now. Neumeier knew what to do, so Squires crawled back to the second car to get in position. This was one action he wished he had been able to rehearse. But though a Spetsnaz soldier might be able to function without sleep for 72 hours, and Israeli Sayeret Sanhanim paratroop recon commandos could land on top of a running camel, and he had seen an Omani Royal Guard officer kill a man with a hat pin to the throat, Squires knew that no soldier in the world could improvise like a striker. That was the beauty of the team, why they fit perfectly with Opsender's mandate to Bronco bust unfolding crises. Squires hooked the detonator to his belt, slipped on his compact respirator, then drew a flashbang grenade from his left hip pouch. He slid the pull ring of the grenade over his right thumb, still holding the safety spoon. Then he pulled an M54 lacrimatory gas canister from its pouch and held it in his left hand, his thumb through the ring. When Neumeier had done likewise, the two men rose slowly in the shadows and stood just to the right of the windows of the first and second cars. Chapter 60, Tuesday, 7:53 a.m., Washington, D.C.
So where is he?
Hood was thinking those exact words, just as Herbert said them. For several minutes now, everyone in his office had been silent, and he'd been replaying the conversation with Orlov in his mind, trying to reassure himself that he hadn't given the Russian anything that could be used against the strikers. Orlov already knew about both groups, and knew where they were. Hood was convinced still that the talk had been about how to defuse the crisis. Orlov could have used his status in Russia long before this to aggrandize himself, if that was what he wanted. He wanted to believe that the cosmonaut was a humanist as well as a patriot. But his son is commanding the train, Hood reminded himself, and that outweighs saintly intentions. Everyone jumped when Hood's phone beeped. He punched the speaker button and answered.
Relay from Stryker Honda, said Bugs Binet.
Let's have it, Hood said, and please bring up the mission map on the computer. Cut in if General Orlov gets back to us. As he spoke, the director slid the phone to the edge of the desk toward Mike Rogers. The general seemed to appreciate the gesture. Honda's voice came through on the secure line, strong and surprisingly clear.
This is Private Honda reporting as ordered.
This is General Rogers. Go ahead, Private.
Sir, the target bridge is in sight and the snows are starting to let up. Three strikers are present at coordinates 9518, 828 to secure the route for retreat. Three strikers are at the train, coordinates 6987, 572. The lieutenant colonel plans to rig the train with C4, get all the passengers off with flashbang and tear gas, take the train and let it blow up farther down the track. He was afraid shrapnel from the boiler might hurt someone. He'll join us at the extraction point when the target has been neutralized.
Hood looked at the grid on the computer screen. The distances involved were tight but manageable.
Private, said Rogers, did the Russians show any sign of standing down?
Sir, we didn't see them. The lieutenant colonel blew a tree across the track. We heard that. Then we heard the train coming, we heard the brakes, and we heard it stop. But we can't see it from here.
Any shooting?
No, sir, said Honda.
If it's necessary to get an order to the beta team, can it be done? Rogers asked.
Not without one of us going back, said Honda. They won't be answering the radio. Sir, I've got to join the others, but I'll try and report any new developments.
Rogers thanked him and wished him well as Hood beeped Binet on the second line. He asked for up-to-the-minute surveillance photos of the site to be sent to his printer as soon as they were received by the NRO. Both Rogers and Herbert went to the printer behind Hood's desk to wait for the hard copy to arrive. A moment later, Orlov came back on the computer monitor. He looked more worried than before, and Hood clandestinely motioned for Liz to come over. She stood to the side, out of range of the fiber-optic camera on top, but was able to see Orlov's face.
"Forgive the delay," Orlov said. "I told the radio officer to have the train stopped and to get my son on the line, but then the link went dead. I honestly don't know what has happened."
"I've learned that my team put a tree across the track," said Hood, "but I don't believe there was a collision."
"Then perhaps my order was relayed in time," said Orlov.
Hood saw the general look down.
"Nikita is calling," said the general. "Gentlemen, I will be back."
The image winked off, and Hood turned to Liz. "What's your impression?"
"Eyes steady, voice a little hollow, shoulders rounded," she said. "Looks like a man telling the truth and not happy with the weight of it."
"That's how I read him." Hood smiled. "Thanks, Liz." She smiled back.
"You're very welcome."
And then the printer began to hum, and suddenly both Rogers and Herbert looked to Hood much as Orlov had, as they watched the first photograph roll from the slot of the digital imager. Chapter 61, Tuesday, 10:54 p.m., Khabarovsk. Repair of the uplink cable was hampered by the fact that the tips of Corporal Fodor's fingers were numb from the cold. Squatting beside the dish, he'd had to cut away an inch of casing with a pocket knife in order to expose enough wire to twist and poke into the contact. The fact that two of the civilians were watching him, discussing better ways of stripping wire, didn't help. When Fodor finally finished, he handed the receiver to the lieutenant, who was standing directly behind him. Fodor's movements were not triumphant, but quick and economical.
"Nikita," General Orlov said,
Are you all right?
Yes, General. We're clearing away a tree. I want you to stop.
Sir? Nikita asked.
I want you to call in your command. You're not to engage the American soldiers, do you understand?
Icy air blew through the window against his back, but that wasn't what made Nikita cold.
General, don't ask me to surrender.
You won't have to, said Orlov. But you will obey my orders. Is that clear?
Nikita hesitated.
Completely, he replied.
I'm in contact with the American commander, Orlov said. Keep the line open, and I'll give you further...
Nikita didn't hear the rest. There was a dull clunk on the wooden floor of the train. He turned away from the phone and saw the grenade roll toward him slowly. An instant later, it erupted in a flurry of intensely bright flashes and loud pops. The people in the car began to shout, and he heard another thud, followed by the hiss of escaping gas. Even as he drew his pistol and made his way to the door at the front of the car, Nikita couldn't help but think about how clever this was. A flash grenade to make them shut their eyes, followed by tear gas to make sure they kept them shut. But without the optic damage that might have resulted from taking the gas in open eyes in such a tight space. No permanent disfigurement to take to the United Nations, the lieutenant thought angrily. Nikita guessed that the Americans were attempting to smoke his soldiers out and capture them in order to make off with the money. No doubt the attackers had already scattered to positions in the surrounding countryside, and it wouldn't pay to send troops after them into the dark. But the commandos wouldn't get him, and they wouldn't get his cargo. As he felt his way through the dark with his left hand, he cursed his father for believing the Americans could be trusted, that they, and not General Kosygin, had Russia's best interests at heart. As he neared the door, Nikita shouted,
"Sergeant Versky, cover us!"
"Yes, sir,"
Versky yelled back. When he reached the front of the car and emerged from the rolling clouds of tear gas, Nikita opened his eyes. He saw Versky's men splayed belly down in the snow, ready to shoot any sign of enemy fire. Behind him, Corporal Fodor and another soldier were helping the disoriented civilians from the train. Nikita backed away from the car. He called to a soldier on top, who was facing the other side of the train.
"Private Cheeser, do you see anything?"
"No, sir."
"How can that be?"
Nikita yelled.
"The grenades came from that side. No one approached, sir."
This was impossible, Nikita thought. Those hand grenades were lobbed in, not fired from a rocket launcher. Someone had to have been close to the train, and then it occurred to him that if someone was, there would be footprints in the snow. His frozen breath trailing behind him, Nikita trudged through the deep snow toward the engine to look on the other side. Chapter 62, Tuesday, 10:56 p.m., Abarovsk. Crouched behind a boulder the size of his dad's vintage T-Bird, Sergeant Chick Gray didn't actually see Squires and Neumeyer toss their grenades through the windows of the train. But when the pride of Long Island Valley Streams South High School track and field team saw the snow turn from charcoal to magnesium white, it was as if a starting gun had gone off. He'd already snatched a look at the engine, and now he spun around the boulder, legs churning, body bent low as he raced toward it through the snow. He saw Squires and Neumeyer pull themselves up through the respective windows of the boxcars. He listened for the distinctive sound of the Berettas, didn't hear it, then saw smoke pour from the back door of the second car, then caught a glimpse of Neumeyer, bent over the coupling between it and the caboose. A moment later, the red car came free, leaving a soldier firing helplessly from the cupola. Gray felt a rush of pride for what Squires had orchestrated. If no one was hurt, this would be an operation for the Special Forces time capsule. Jerkhole, he thought, and veered to the left, then to the right as he ran. He realized he'd courted doom by anticipating success, and atoned in crude but accepted striker fashion. When he was still several yards from the train, Gray saw a flare-cast shadow moving toward the front of the engine on the other side. Someone was coming around, and not wanting to stop, Gray leapt toward the injector pipe that ran perpendicular to the cab just above the trailing truck. He grabbed it, swung his legs sideways into the window, let go of the pipe, and landed inside, squatting. The engineer turned in surprise. Gray curled the fingers of his left hand tightly, hardening the outside of his hand, and drove it up under the soldier's nose. He followed that with a hatchet kick, driving the side of his left boot into the man's knee and dropping him to the floor. The sergeant didn't want the man unconscious, just cooperative, in case he couldn't figure out how to start the train. But the throttle and floor brake were easy enough to operate, and after kicking the ladder so it was in the upward off position, he pulled the vertical throttle toward him from the left. The train lurched forward.
"Out!"
Gray barked at the soldier. The peach-faced young Russian was fighting to get his legs under him, but gave up, settling on his knees. The striker gestured roughly toward the window.
"Da! Da svidanya!"
he said, using the only Russian he knew.
"Yes, so long."
The Russian hesitated, then made a sudden grab for the Beretta in Gray's left hip holster. The striker cocked his left elbow back hard, into the Russian's temple. The soldier hit the corner of the cab like a fighter caught by a ghost uppercut.
"You dog!" the sergeant snarled.
Pushing the throttle higher, Gray scooped the Russian onto his shoulder as if he were a sack of flour, hoisted him to the window, and dumped him back first into a passing snowbank. He took a moment to look back and saw Russian soldiers running to try and catch the train. But gunfire from the two cars drove them back, and soon the Stryker Express was running into the night at three-quarters throttle. When the train started up, Nikita was just coming around the cowcatcher. Jumping back off the track, he grabbed the handrail of the ladder behind and above the cowcatcher and walked up the three steps to the platform. Crouching there, his back against the boilerplate, he held his AKR submachine gun tight against his side and watched, with rising anger, as Private Maksimych was hurled from the window and the other Americans fired to send his men, the rightful owners of the train, rushing behind trees and rocks for cover.
"These are the men my father courted," he seethed, as the last of the tear gas curled from the windows and the locomotive picked up speed.
Still crouching, Nikita switched the short-barreled gun to his left hand and stepped 2 feet up from the platform onto the ledge above the air reservoir. The narrow walkway ran above the injector pipe midway up to the boiler, and as he held onto the narrow handrail that ran along the top of the engine, the junior lieutenant held the short-barreled submachine gun toward the cab. And as Nikita passed under the steam dome, just 8 feet from the cab, the unsuspecting American soldier looked out. Chapter 63, Tuesday, 4:02 p.m., Moscow. Interior Minister Dugin was feeling good, very good. Sitting alone in his office for the first time that day, he savored his impending triumph. General Kosygin's troops were moving into Ukraine without incident. There were even reports of expatriate Russians and Ukrainians alike greeting them with Soviet flags. Polish troops were being moved to the border with Ukraine. NATO and the United States shifted troops from England to Germany, and in Germany toward Poland, and there was a blustery show of strength as NATO warplanes flew over Warsaw. But not a single non-Polish troop entered the country on the ground. Nor would they. Not with Russian operatives ready to raise hell in tinderboxes around the world. The United States would watch Russia recover its historic sphere of influence before allowing American soldiers to be spread out in rebellions and invasions from Latin America to the Middle East. Right now, Dugin's emissary in Washington, Deputy Chief of Mission Savitsky, was discussing Russian objectives in a closed-door meeting at the State Department. Zhanyin's new ambassador had already had his meeting with Secretary of State Lincoln. By taking the second meeting, the U.S. had unofficially acknowledged that there was a second viable government in Russia, one that needed to be reckoned with. And Grozny didn't even have to bomb a city to get that acknowledgement. Dugin's new political friends had agreed to wait for their money, and President Zhanyin was finding roadblocks in the information and command conduits. He could not respond quickly or accurately, and Dugin took pride in how much more effective this was than the failed coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. It wasn't necessary to isolate the leader with guns and soldiers. All one had to do was hamstring his ability to see and hear, and he was helpless. Dugin chuckled contentedly. What could the idiot do? Go on the air and tell the electorate that he didn't know what was going on in the government? Could someone please tell him? The minister's one fear, that Shovich would get restless with the unexpected delay, failed to materialize. No doubt he had already used one of his fake passports to leave the country, staying on the move like Patton during World War II to confuse his enemies and rivals. Not that it mattered to Dugin where Shovich was. He would be content if the worm remained beneath a rock somewhere. Thus far, he thought, the only disappointment has been Sergei Orlov. The minister and his allies were trying to make their sick country well, which required circumventing the laws. He had expected an orderly, traditional-minded man like the general to be unhappy with their unorthodoxy, but he hadn't expected him to challenge them by pulling rank on Colonel Roski. Doing so, Dugin reflected confidently, Orlov had effectively ended his career. He'd quit the Russian line and joined the British 27th Lancers for their ride into the Valley of Death. Dugin felt bad for him, but Orlov had done his job, helped get reluctant politicians to go along with Operations Center funding, because he was a man of integrity and honor. And he would have been allowed to stay, if only he'd joined the team. The minister looked at the antique maps on his walls and felt a thrill as he contemplated adding a new old one, the reborn Soviet Union. He glanced at his watch, noted that the storm should have passed by now, and the money train should be reaching Khabarovsk. He picked up the telephone and asked his assistant to get General Orlov on the line. Once the train's arrival had been confirmed, he would have an airplane sent to meet them in Birobidzhan, the capital of the Jewish region on the Biro River. The Dalzilmash harvester factory had a landing strip that would accommodate a medium-sized military aircraft. The man who got on the line was not the wary but composed officer he'd spoken to earlier. He was surprisingly aggressive.
"Your plan has gone sour," the general said bluntly.
The minister was suspicious.
"Which plan? Has something happened to the train?"
"You could say that," Olaf replied.
"As we speak, American commandos are attacking it."
Dugin sat up very straight.
"The train was your responsibility, your son's."
"I'm sure Nikita is doing his best to hold them off," Orlov said. "And the Americans are at a disadvantage. They don't want to hurt our people."
"They would be insane to," Dugin replied. "Where is Roski?"
"Chasing spies," Orlov said. "But they eluded him. They caught the man who was tailing them and used his radio to put me in touch with an operations center in Washington. That's how I know about their plan. We tried to work things out."
"I don't want to hear about your failures," Dugin said. "I want Roski found, and when he is, you're relieved of your command."
"You forget," Orlov said. "Only the president can replace me."
"You will resign, General Orlov, or I'll have you removed from the center."
"How will Roski and his brown shirts get in?" Orlov asked. "As of now, the center will be sealed off." Dugin warned.
"They will take it back."
"Perhaps," Orlov said. "But not in time to help you save your train. Or your cause."
"General," Dugin yelled, "think about what you're doing. Think about your son, your wife."
"I love them," Orlov said. "But I'm thinking about Russia now. I only wish I weren't alone. Goodbye, Minister." Orlov hung up, and for nearly a minute, Dugin sat squeezing the phone. It was impossible to imagine that he had come so far, only to be undermined by Orlov's betrayal. His brow flushed, hands shaking with rage, he set down the receiver and had his assistant call Air Force General Daka. The Americans had to have come in by air, and no doubt were planning to get out the same way, fast and dirty. He would make that impossible, and if anything happened to his cargo, the Americans would have to replace the money. Or their soldiers would be returned to them through Shovich, a piece at a time. Chapter 64. Tuesday, 11:10 p.m., Khabarovsk. Squires peered through the last thin puffs of tear gas as they floated to the ceiling and then wound out the window and door. His eyes and mouth protected by gear that already seemed a part of him, his ears alert for danger, he ran to the cases stacked or strewn haphazardly in the rear of the car. He used his lapel knife to pry up the edge of one of the wooden crates. It was money, lots of it, the profits of suffering earmarked to cause more suffering. Instead, he thought, looking at his watch, in 32 minutes it will be confetti. He and his mini-team would ride the rails another 20 minutes to where the Russians wouldn't be able to reach the train. Then they would hike toward the bridge, as behind them, like Sodom and Gomorrah, the two cars of this rotten bank would blow cloud high. He experienced the flush of righteousness that Americans from Thomas Jefferson to Rosa Parks must have felt, the satisfaction and pride of saying no to something wrong, to someone corrupt. Squires started toward the rear door of the train. As he was about to enter the second car to check on Neumeier, his head was wrenched around by the sound of gunfire. "From the engine?" he thought. "How can that be?" Gray wouldn't be shooting at anyone now that they were underway. Calling for Neumeier, Squires ran toward the front of the car, stepped into the black clouds that fierce winds were pounding down from the smokestack, and felt his way cautiously around the coal tender. There had only been time for a brief burst, but Nikita knew he'd tagged the American. He'd seen the way his shoulder had jerked back, saw the dark splash of blood on the camouflage whites. Nikita moved rapidly along the side of the locomotive. It seemed cut off from the rest of the train, which was hidden behind clouds of coal smoke and glittering particles of wind-blown snow. Upon reaching the cab, he lowered his gun and edged along the injector pipe toward the window. He looked in. The cab was empty. His eyes darted from corner to corner, which were lit by the dull orange coal fire. He looked up as a dark forehead and then the barrel of a Beretta poked down from the roof of the cab. Nikita dove through the window, catching a bullet in the back of his right thigh as the American sprayed the side of the train with gunfire. Grimacing, Nikita squeezed his leg with his left hand as blood dampened the back of his trousers. The wound ached as though his thigh were in a tight vise, but what bothered Nikita more was that he hadn't anticipated the American going out the window and over the top of the cab. The question was, what would he do now? Nikita got off his back, putting his weight on his left leg, and hobbled toward the throttle. The important thing was to stop the train and buy his troops time to catch them. His eyes shifted from window to window as he crossed the cab, the barrel of his gun raised, his finger crooked around the trigger. The American would have to come back in to start the train up again, and the only way to enter was by one of the two windows. And then there was another sickeningly familiar thud, and the cab erupted with burning white light.
No!
Nikita bellowed as he shut his eyes and backed against the rear wall of the cab. The roar of the flashbang grenades was amplified by the close quarters and metal walls of the cabin. He pressed his hands to his ears to protect them, cursing his helplessness. He couldn't even fire blindly around the cab for fear of being struck by his own ricocheting bullet. But it mustn't end this way, he told himself. Staggering toward the front of the cab, Nikita tried to use the side of his left leg to nudge the throttle back. But he was unable to stand on his right leg, and, dropping to his knees, he put his left hand on the throttle. Screaming from the pain of the ear-splitting blasts, he pulled the throttle toward him only to be pushed away by a hard boot heel. Nikita made a futile attempt to grab whoever was there, but clutched only air and light. He swung the gun to the left and right, hoping to strike flesh, to find his target.
"Fight me!"
he screamed.
"Coward!"
Then the brightness died and the explosions stopped, and the only sound was the loud buzz in Nikita's ears and the banging of his heart. Peering into the dark, the lieutenant saw a figure slumped in a corner. The blood had crystallized from the cold, but he recognized the wound, saw that he had blasted several holes in the jacket, but only one shell caught what appeared to be the outside edge of a bulletproof vest. He raised his gun and aimed it at the man's forehead, just above the goggles.
"Don't!"
a voice to Nikita's left said in English. The Russian officer turned and saw Beretta pointing at him from outside the window. Behind it was a tall, powerful figure, dressed the same as the wounded man. He would be damned if a lawless raider was going to dictate terms. Nikita swung his gun around quickly, intending to shoot whether the other man fired or not. But the man lying in the corner suddenly came to life, locking his legs around Nikita's torso, flopping him onto his back and holding him there as the other man entered and disarmed him. Nikita grappled with the man, but the pain in his leg kept him from standing or putting up much of a fight. The newcomer knelt on Nikita's chest, pinning him, and used the bottom of his boot to kick the throttle forward, driving the speed of the train back up again. Still camped on Nikita's chest, he pulled off what looked like a rappelling belt and lashed the ankle of Nikita's good leg to a handle just below the window. The Russian could neither reach it nor escape, and for the second time that night he felt ashamed. The two of them planned this together on the roof of the cab, he thought bitterly, and I stumbled into it like a sports club novice. Our apologies, Lieutenant, the man said in English as he stood and raised his goggles. A third man reached the cabin and, after shouting in, was told to enter. He swung in through the window. The new arrival tended to his companion's wound by the light of the coals, while the other man, obviously the group's leader, bent to look at Nikita's wound. While he did so, Nikita reached out with his left arm to try and push the throttle. The leader grabbed his wrist and the Russian tried to kick at him with his free foot, but the pain was too great. They don't give medals for suffering, the man said to Nikita. As Nikita lay there panting, the leader pulled an empty rope bag from around his shin, used a small knife to cut off the strap, and slipped the band around the blood-soaked leg, just above the wound. He gave it a firm pull. He used another length of strap to bind his hands and tie them to an iron hook on the floor of the train. We'll be leaving the train in a few minutes, the man said. We'll take you off and see that you get medical attention. Nikita had no idea what he was saying, nor did he care. These men were the enemy, and one way or another he was going to stop them from doing whatever they planned. His hands behind him, he used his thumbnail to dig the glass stone from his regimental ring. It had been designed to come free like that. It had also been designed so that a half-inch blade would pop up from beneath the stone when it came out. And with no one watching his hands, he began to saw against the leather strap. Chapter 65 Tuesday, 4:27 p.m., St. Petersburg. After making their way through the strikers, Peggy and George had gone to the restrooms at the Hermitage and changed into the clothes they carried, the Western-style jeans, button-down shirts, and Nikes favored by Russian youth. They folded their uniforms into their backpacks, then walked hand-in-hand up the large state staircase to the first floor of the large Hermitage, the home of the museum's extensive collection of Western European art. One of the gems of the collection, Raphael's Conestabile Madonna, painted in 1502, is named for the city in central Italy that had been its home for centuries. The round painting is 7 inches tall by 7 inches wide, nestled in an ornate gold frame, as wide on each side as the art, and shows the Madonna in a blue robe sitting in front of rolling hills cradling the infant Jesus in her arms. Peggy and George had arrived shortly before Volka was due. Peggy acted as though she was looking at art when she was actually keeping an eye on the Raphael. George, who had never even seen a photograph of the operative, was holding her hand lightly as his eyes ranged from painting to painting. Because it wasn't his wife's hand, he felt guilty enjoying Peggy's touch, the warmth of her fingers against his palm, the feathery lightness of her fingertips against the side of his hand. Thinking about how deadly that hand could be made her touch that much more electric. At exactly 4:29, Peggy's hand tensed, though she didn't break her stride. George glanced toward the Raphael. A man about 6'2" was walking slowly around the side of the room toward the painting. He was dressed in loose white chinos, brown shoes, and a blue windbreaker that bulged around a spreading waist. As he neared the Raphael, Peggy squeezed George's hand harder. The Russian cut across the room and was headed toward the right side of the painting, not the left. Peggy gently tugged George around, then led him slowly toward the door. She hugged his arm now with both of hers, letting him support her. All the while her eyes searched the room, moving slowly instead of darting, so as not to attract attention. Everyone else in the room was moving or looking at paintings,